All right, so let's look at some of the common questions people have about what heaven is going to be like at this point. Let's start with this question. Can believers in the present heaven see events on earth? Like if a loved one dies who's a believer, are they going to be able to know what's happening on earth? This is kind of a controversial question because we know that some people pray to dead loved ones and pray to saints. And so for many evangelicals, they just say to this resoundingly, no, no way can saints, believers, you know, be able to know what's happening on earth. I don't know. I wonder if that's an overreaction to the concept of praying to saints. It's not that we should pray to them, but is it that they know what's happening with us? Revelation 18:20 says, "Rejoice over her, O heaven, and you saints and apostles and prophets, because God has pronounced judgment for you." So what's happening on earth in Revelation 18, they're telling the saints to rejoice over this. I don't know if it's a news broadcast in heaven, if they can see it. I don't know what it is, but it says in Revelation 19:1, a great multitude in heaven will rejoice over the destruction of Babylon. So they're getting information about what's happening on earth. Apparently they must know. Okay, that's pretty general though. That's pretty big. Let's think of Luke 15:10. Jesus says, "There is joy in the presence of angels of God over one sinner who repents." For years, I took that to mean that the angels are rejoicing every time a person comes to Christ. That could be the case. However, that's not what it says. It says there is joy in the presence of the angels. Again, Alcorn says that that could mean that it's the believers in heaven who are in the presence of angels experience joy. I don't know. It could be either. This doesn't mean that we should pray to dead loved ones. We know that human beings who die and go to heaven, the present heaven, they don't gain the attribute of omniscience where they know everything and they can answer prayers and hear prayer. Nothing like that. That's not a biblical concept. In fact, the Bible outlaws communicating with the dead. Deuteronomy 18, Leviticus 20. Even 1 Samuel 28, where Saul is trying to get the witch of Endor to contact Samuel, Samuel shows up not to give him some special information, but to pronounce judgment on him. So the one passage you have that could say that you could pray to somebody who's dead and a believer, it actually is proving the opposite, that it brings judgment. Jesus taught us to pray to our Father who is in heaven, Matthew 6:9. Paul says, "Let our requests be made known to God, not to dead people, not to angels." Colossians 2, don't worship angels, don't pray to angels. The thought in the mind of Paul, if we don't worship angels and we don't pray to angels, how much more should we not pray to dead people? In every recorded prayer in the Bible, we don't have a single example of praying to a dead person. How about that? Every prayer is to be issued to God. The closest thing you could get is 1 Samuel 28. And the result is judgment. So that would not be a good proof text there. What about this question? Will there be sex in heaven? God's definitely pro-sex. This is something to think about. He created sex here. He's for it. He gave us the anatomy. We're not going to lose the anatomy for sex when we get to heaven. We're still going to have that. Let's think about Jesus' teaching, however. He says in Matthew 22:30, "In the resurrection, they are neither married nor are they given in marriage." He says, "We'll be like the angels." This would be the one passage that would seem to preclude sex in heaven. In the resurrection, they neither marry nor are given in marriage. So, not explicitly clear, but it sounds like no sex. C.S. Lewis has the illustration in his book, Miracles, which is really a philosophy book. You know, C.S. Lewis, he was a expert in ancient literature, all things literature, and yet he writes a book on miracles. It's considered one of the best philosophical texts on miracles. The guy was just a genius. Anyhow, in the book, he makes this illustration about a little boy that you're talking to, and you ask the little boy, so do you want to go to heaven? And he's like, yeah, what's it going to be like? Oh, man, it's going to be amazing. Yeah, you know, no sin, and it's going to be a city. It's going to be like a family. It's going to be awesome. And then the little boy's like, yeah, that sounds cool, but is my favorite candy going to be there? And, you know, the adult's like, no, maybe. I don't know. Don't worry about it. It's like heaven. It's going to be heaven. And the little boy's like, well, I don't know if my favorite candy's not going to be there. I don't want to be there. I'd be like, heaven, heaven. I think the same thing is true here. People are so obsessed with sex in our culture. It's just like that's the end all be all. I really wonder about that. Even now, we use the expression better than sex to describe certain things. Like, we went to the Florida Keys, and there's this restaurant that serves only desserts. And the name of the restaurant is Better Than Sex. And so it's basically the point that our desserts are really good. Drinks, sex on the beach, stuff like that. I don't know. Is it possible that you could just stretch your imagination enough to think that there could be something greater than sex for a second? There is. It's called heaven. And whatever it is up there, we're not going to be worried about this. So that's my view on that. Will we eat and drink in heaven? This seems to be very clear. Yes, we will. Remember 1 John 3:2, Jesus ate and drank, and if we're going to be like him in his resurrected body, then we too will eat and drink. What about this question? Will there be animals or pets in heaven? Let's think about that. In the garden, this is probably the closest thing we have to heaven, this side of it, the garden in Eden. There was animals there. And the book of Revelation seems to make a lot of allusions hearkening back to the Garden of Eden. So it would seem to follow that if we have a renewed heaven, a renewed earth, it's going to be a physical planet, that there would be animals there, to be sure. Remember Romans 8:21, God's going to liberate creation, not annihilate it. So I would be a proponent that there's animals there. Some theologians, Johnny Erickson Tada, for example, would say no to the idea that your pet Scruffy is going to be in heaven, that all dogs go to heaven. She says this based on Ecclesiastes 3:21, that they go down to the earth. Some say yes. Randy Alcorn, for example, in his book, he says that yes, we will have pets in heaven. Billy Graham was one of the proponents of that too, that if you love that pet, why wouldn't God bring that pet into heaven with you? I don't know. Not really sure. What I can be sure of is that this shouldn't be our focus. I have a buddy who worked up at the study center, and this woman came in with Randy Alcorn's book. Have I plugged Randy Alcorn's book, Heaven, enough? This teaching? It's like a 500-page book. She returns it. She says, I read the whole book. He said, what'd you think of it? She was like, oh, I loved it. It was awesome. I didn't know that we were going to have pets in heaven. And my buddy was like, oh, yeah, I mean, that's certainly possible. Did you know that God is going to be there too? Yeah. How about that? Oh, I'm so glad my pet is going to be there. Your pet, your dog, I think you're dyslexic. God is going to be there. Don't forget about God. How old will we be? Well, in heaven, that's really not a good way of putting it, is it? Because you'll continue to be old. I mean, at one point we'll be 3,000 years old. Maybe a better question is, how old will we look in heaven? I mean, think about it. If an infant dies, I believe in infant salvation, that they didn't reach the age of accountability, so they're covered by the sacrifice of Christ. Will infants be perpetually 3 months old in heaven? Just constantly having babies there forever? Will an elderly believer remain 95 for all of eternity? Will Billy Graham be 99 years old? up there when we meet him? Do we come back to life at the age we died or at some other age? You see the question? Okay, we don't really know. Not really sure. Adam and Eve seemed like they were adults when they were created. Doesn't seem like they went through infancy. They were at least to the point of puberty because they were able to be fruitful and multiply. When Jesus dies and comes back in his resurrected body, it seems that he's the same age, the same point at which he died, which would be in his 30s. But he died in his 30s, so that doesn't really answer it. Some theologians just say 30. Alistair McGrath, A Brief History of Heaven, he just says, yeah, I think we'll come back at age 30. No explanation. One way of thinking about this is Erwin Lutzer is his name, Erwin Lutzer. He says that if a baby dies at 3 months old, that in heaven, that baby will come back as a baby and yet will be given to a mother, presumably the baby's mother, to be raised to the point of maturity. That is an interesting concept. So the mother who's had the 3 miscarriages could never have a child. The mother who lost the child as a baby, who could never, you know, experience the love of the child, that God will bring him back at that age so that the mother gets to raise the child only in perfection. Not sure. Will heaven be an eternal church service? This is one of the objections raised against heaven by skeptics. Here's P.Z. Myers. This is from his blog, Sunday Sacrilege, Imagine No Heaven. He says, who would want to even visit heaven? Heaven with all its smug and judgmental inhabitants praising God nonstop with pursed lips and suspicious eyes. Yeah. The suspicious eyes part, I don't really get. Will heaven be an eternal church service? Huh. This could be more of a critique of contemporary church culture than of heaven. Like being dragged to church as a kid where you sing songs you don't like, you're with people you don't enjoy, listening to a preacher that you can't follow or puts you to sleep or you hate. And so maybe we're actually projecting contemporary church culture or experience onto heaven when really that's putting the cart before the horse. The imagery that we get of what heaven is going to be like is it's going to be ecstatic at times. I like to think of, you know, how people will pay hundreds of dollars to get tickets to a rock concert. It's like, why do they do that? It's because they love the band, to be in the presence of greatness, to be in the presence of glory, you might say, to hear the music, to sing the songs, the camaraderie of the people who like the same music. I remember taking my old man to go see an OSU football game. We got into the student section. Neither of us looked the part, but somehow we snuck in there. So we're with all these students in the student section and Brutus the Buckeye is out there doing the thing, getting the team all ramped up and the students all ramped up and everyone's chanting and screaming back and forth. And then finally the team takes the field. Welcome the Ohio State Buckeye! And everyone in the whole room is just like, oh, you know, screaming. And that feeling of like 80,000 fans in the horseshoe and you just feel it right in your chest gets you right in the feels. You're like, oh, this is awesome. And this is really what the picture is here. It's not that there is going to be singing. We get that in the book of Revelation. But it'll be singing music you like, first of all. And it will be in kind of an arena where you're seeing not a rock singer in skinny jeans that you think is really glorious. You're going to be seeing Jesus Christ, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, and just to be there in the presence of true greatness with an innumerable number of people, and we're all there together. We also know that that's not the only activity. It's not just sitting around singing songs all the time. For one, most of the quote-unquote worship services in the book of Revelation, most are not sung. They're shouted. Go through and do a study. of the worship services in heaven. Some of them are sung, yes. Sing a new song. Song of Moses is brought up in Revelation. Most of the time, the believers are screaming at God. That's really more akin to like a rock concert or a football game. I guess that's my point. Where it's just like Jesus Christ walks up onto the throne. Yeah! You know, just screaming. And no, it's not going to be a church service. What about the objection that heaven will become boring eventually? Like maybe the idea that, you know, you're there for 1,000 years. Whoa, this is sweet. 2,000 years. This is pretty cool. 500,000 years. 1,000,000 years, you know. Is this eventually going to get to the point where you're just like, man, this is getting old? Carol Zaleski of Harvard says, our ancestors were afraid of hell. We are afraid of heaven. We think it will be boring. We used to have a video of a bunch of guys had gotten together to make a video of people going to heaven. The guy gets up there. They even had the fog machine and everything. I mean, this is like really high-tech stuff here. And the guy's there, and he's there, and it's at the bottom of the screen. It says, after 10 years. And the guy's playing the harp, and he's got the wings and the fog machine. He's just so happy, banging away at the harp. And then it, you know, fades to black, and it says, after 500 years. And the guy's playing the harp, you know, and then it, after 5,000 years, and the guy's just sitting there, ring, ring. And then, you know, after 1,000,000 years, he's just laying there on the ground on the harp, you know, half dead. And finally, the punchline comes where he turns to the angel and he says, you know, I got to get out of here. This really is annoying. He says, send me to hell instead. And the angel turns back and says, where do you think you've been this whole time? I came to return this girl's sweater. She's been dead for 10 years. It's kind of one of those moments. Anyways, no, it's not going to become boring. Why? Here's one reason. How long will it take for a finite creature to search the depths of an infinite creator? How long will that take? Eternity. What if there is a subject in which you could never fully exhaust the knowledge of? Usually, we say the time seems to drag when we're dissatisfied. You know, the last hour of your work shift always just seems to just drag by. Just keep looking at the clock. Oh, good Lord, 4:04 p.m. And then you do a bunch of stuff and you look back, 4:07 p.m. Oh, you keep working more, 3:59 p.m.? How's that even possible? It just seems to like take forever. And yet, when we're on, you know, our 20th date with our sweetie pie, and we're falling in love for the first time, you just say, wow, time just seems to fly by. Or we have the expression, time stands still. Could be the same thing here. If you're bored, if your life is terrible, then yeah, time seems to drag, and yet if you're enjoying it, you don't even look at the, you don't look at the clock. If you're on a date with a wonderful person and you're really enjoying yourself, you're not thinking to yourself, 4:04 p.m., I'm still with this person. We won't be thinking about time. Another thought that came to me since writing my book on the topic, wish I could have had this in there, is that just because we are going to be in resurrected bodies and we're going to be something we can't conceive of now, there is a question as to whether we will be able to forget things in heaven, which I think we can. If you're living for 1,000,000, 2,000,000, 5,000,000 years, will you remember every single second of every single day for those 5,000,000 years? No, I don't think so. We're not going to become a perfect memory, really. If that's true, if it's true that you could live for a long time and forget things, this means that you could become a complete expert at the guitar, let's say. You could take voice lessons, become a great singer. You could become a chess master. You could become the greatest basketball. You could become the GOAT of basketball. You could You know, learn this hobby, learn how to fish, learn how to build a house. You can learn all these skills and actually reach the point of expertise and then be like, cool. Okay, now I'm going to learn something else. And you can learn that. And by the time you become a master at that, you could go back to the piano and be like playing chopsticks again. So it could be that you could learn and then relearn things. I don't know. I think that's interesting to consider. Maybe you would never finally exhaust everything because we're not going to have a perfect memory. What about the objection, you're so heavenly minded that you're no earthly good? Yeah. You Christians are always thinking about heaven, what heaven's going to be like. And really what that does is it absolves you of caring about things here on earth. Because your head is always in the clouds thinking about heaven when really we got problems down here that you're not dealing with. I wonder about that objection, honestly. Imagine you're a prisoner of war. Your country just won the war. You somehow get word through the grapevine, I've been in this POW camp for 3 years, and yet our country won the war. They're on their way. They're going to be here to this prison camp in a week. So you've been trying to manage your food, your scraps, your water, whatever medicine you can get your hands on. I mean, it's kind of a dog-eat-dog thing in this prison camp. And yet you know there's an end to this. You know there's an end in a week, let's say, where they're going to come and liberate the camp. Here's the question. Would this make you more or less likely to share your limited supply of food and clean water with your fellow POWs? If you thought that this was just going to go on for year after year after year and then you die, would that make you want to give up your limited resources? But if you knew that you were eventually going to break out of this prison in a relatively short amount of time, and these food scraps you're collecting and water reserves aren't going to mean anything relatively soon, wouldn't you rather give those away? Wouldn't you, like, for example, if you had a buddy, a fellow POW who was dying, wouldn't you rather like give away some of your resources so that you could get him alive, so that he could get back to the United States and survive, make it past the POW camp? You see where the illustration's going? Why, if this life is all I have, why would that be motivating to me to give away the limited resources and money and experiences I could have? However, if I know that I'm going somewhere for eternity where all my needs are met, wouldn't that make me more motivated to give away? Because this life is not all that there is. Hope, very important when it comes to altruism, generosity. Think about these two guys here. I don't know their story. But let's just say this guy on the left, his family, his wife, his kids, they died during the war, and he's in that POW camp. However, this guy over here, his wife, family, and kids are alive and are waiting for him after the war. Ask yourself the question, which man do you think will have more motivation to endure his suffering? One of the things you read about when you read about these stories is the idea of hope. Think about Viktor Frankl in his work, Man's Search for Meaning. He was a Holocaust survivor. The concept of hope, that this is moving towards something, meaning the person with hope is going to do better than the person without it. Will we have free will in heaven? Yes, we will. And yet people say, oh, we got a contradiction here, pal. You're going to have free will. Does that mean that eventually we could sin and start another fall? That this is just going to be a cyclical thing? No. So wait a minute. We're going to have free will, but you're saying we're never going to fall again. Yes. How? Because something is different now. The cross of Christ. God couldn't actualize a world with Adam and Eve where the cross had already happened. That's logically impossible. You have to have free-willed humans who fall, then bring in the cross, the death of the God-man, the greatest expression of divine love conceivable, and then people trust in that, and then they go to heaven, and then he actualizes heaven. At that point in heaven, you'd be thinking to yourself, why would I ever want to rebel against God again? Like this. Here's an example. There's my little buddy, my son. Okay. I look at that and I'm like, do I have the free will to just pick him up and body slam him on the ground? Yeah, I do. I've got the free will to do that. Would I ever do that? No. I mean, why would I? It's like I could if I wanted to. Well, why not? Well, because I have such love for that person, I would never even think about doing that. Well, to make a point here, our love for Christ, or rather his love for us, is going to be so powerful, way more than a father-child relationship. It's going to be so much more powerful that you will have the freedom to turn away from Christ, and yet you will never freely choose to do so. What about this objection? If we grieve at funerals, does that mean that we really don't believe? Some skeptics have argued that, you know, when Christians are at funerals, they grieve just like everyone else. They're sobbing their eyes out. They don't really believe that there's an afterlife. In fact, let's read, or let's listen to Ian McEwan. He's one of the most prolific novelists today. This is from the movie The Unbelievers, Richard Dawkins and Lawrence Krauss.
I think people don't really believe the myths they invent. I've been to many funerals in which the priest has spoken of an afterlife, and even the people who are there are sobbing profusely. They don't really think they're going to meet their loved one in 5 years' time. If, on the other hand, you stood on the quayside and watched Queen Mary set off for New York, the people on the quayside are not crying because they know they're going to see those people again fairly soon. A funeral is fundamentally different, yet it should be the same.
You see his point? It's like if you're seeing your friend leave for a little bit and they're coming back, you wouldn't be crying that much. And yet at a funeral, we are. So he's showing some inconsistency there. On the other hand, Jesus wept at a funeral. John 11:35. What does that mean? What is he saying? Is he saying Jesus of Nazareth was a phony? Jesus of Nazareth didn't really believe in God? Are we really to believe that? Jacob wept profusely. David wept profusely at the death of his son. Godly men wept over Stephen in Acts 8:2. Godly men. Paul was deeply grieved at the near death of Epaphroditus. The point here is that when we read the Bible, we see that the people do grieve over death. We don't grieve for the fact that they are in heaven, which is better by far. That's not why we grieve. We grieve because we are currently separated from our loved one. That's why we're grieving. That person that you've seen every day, that you care about, you no longer see them. Like, I don't agree with his illustration. If you're at the Queen Mary and somebody's leaving, so you see a friend who's hopping on a boat, who's leaving for 40 years, you wouldn't cry profusely? We had friends that we sent overseas to do missions work. My wife grieved over that for over a year. That's how difficult it was for her. Yes, you would grieve. Absolutely you would. Death is not like that illustration where you're having the person leave and then come back. Death is sudden. It's severe. It's painful. It's not like seeing somebody hop on a boat and go over to Europe or something. I mean, it's very quick. It's out of the blue. No, it has nothing to do with what he's claiming there. Paul says we should grieve, or rather not grieve, like people who have no hope. To grieve and to think that I'm never going to see this person again, he says that would be sub-Christian. But we do grieve as Christians, absolutely. But we grieve in a different way. We grieve with hope rather than grieve without hope. What about this question? How can we be resurrected if our bodies have been completely destroyed? What if a cannibal tribe eats you and digests you and defecates you in the woods? What about that? Well, presumably they wouldn't eat the bones, so I guess there'd still be bones. What if you were put into a meat grinder and you were just completely put up? What if you fell into an incinerator? What if you're cremated? How can our bodies be resurrected if we've been completely destroyed? An argument which sounds a lot like the Sadducees in Matthew 22. How about that? There's nothing new under the sun, is there? The Sadducees, well, how could the resurrection be true if this woman married 5 different men? Who's her wife? And Jesus is like, you know nothing. You know not the scriptures nor the power of God. This picture of God is really like the king from Humpty Dumpty, where Humpty Dumpty sat on the wall and had a big fall. All the king's horses couldn't bring out, you know the rhyme. It's like, oh, I don't know how to fix this egg. Oh, that's so terrible. That's not the picture of God in the Bible. God could move every single molecule back in order. However, we should point out that the molecules in my body are not essentially me. Not even now. Cells regenerate. Skin flakes off. The person physically that you are today is not the same as you are tomorrow. It's not the same that you will be a decade from now or 3 decades from now. And so this idea that, well, we have to have the same exact body. Which day? Which day should we compare it to? Physical composition never stays the same. Not even now. And we should point out the fact that God's powerful. Like I said, he's not the king of Humpty Dumpty where, oh, you were cremated. I can't bring you back together. He could bring all those, he knows where all those molecules are, and he does have the power to bring those all together again. In Revelation, it says that some of the bodies are in the sea. He goes into the sea, raises them from the sea. How about that?